Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm glad to have all of you with us again for our show today. And once again today, as we've been doing for weeks now, we're refocusing our show to deal largely with the most, I think, clearly the most important story most of us as journalists are likely to cover in our lifetimes, and that's the spread of coronavirus and efforts in Georgia and the United States and around the world to try to battle against this disease. We will talk politics a little later in the show today. There was an important election result that came out of Wisconsin, and we're going to talk about the implications of that. But first, before I introduce the panel and our very special guest, I'll give you the latest figures that we have from the Department of Health as it relates to Georgia. We now, according to the Department of Health, and this is as of 7 o'clock last night, have 13,621 confirmed cases of COVID-19. That's up 1,071 in 24 hours. We still are reporting cases in basically 157 counties that we know of. I mean, it's possible they're in all 159, but so far the Department of Public Health sees them in 157 counties. And sadly, we have 480 deaths total. That's up 38 deaths in the past 24 hours or so. The other quick thing I'll point out is that, you know, we've all been following the University of Washington, IHME, models for the coronavirus and how it's moving through states and through countries around the world. The Georgia model has shifted a bit. A week or so ago, they projected that we were going to reach a peak here right around April 23rd in terms of the number of cases, in terms of the day that we would need the most beds, the most medical facilities to take care of people with COVID-19. They've now pushed that date back to around May 3rd. And by May 3rd, they're suggesting right now that we might have as many as 91 deaths a day. That's kind of the peak for them. They say that their projections would see us having a total of 3,718 deaths. Of course, those are statistical models, and they've been used widely by government and journalists around the country, so we are paying attention. But again, these are statistical models subject to change. All right. That said, let's get our panel introduced and then our very special guest. Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, joins me. And we're glad to have her with us. Kyle Hayes, who is the producer and interviewer on Peach Pod, which is a terrific podcast about politics in Georgia. Georgia is on his mind a lot, despite the fact that he now lives in Washington and works for a think tank up there. But Kyle's a Georgia native and continues to report on what's happening in politics here. And we have Dr. Amy Steigerwalt, political science professor from Georgia State University, back with us today. So I'm glad that you all could be here, and I want all of you to have an opportunity to talk with our very special guest, Dr. Patrice Harris, who is the president of the American Medical Association. Dr. Harris is an Atlanta-based psychiatrist and public health expert. And she is the first African-American woman to serve as president of the American Medical Association. Dr. Harris, thank you so much. Your schedule, I know how busy it's been because I see you all over the place, and I'm very grateful to you for taking a little time to talk with us today. So welcome to Political Rewind, Dr. Harris.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
So let me start, if I may, with, I think, a question that it's become sort of the question of the day, and that is this notion that the virus has reached a peak in many parts of the United States, and it is time for the country to think about reopening for business. That's certainly what President Trump talks a lot about. But here in Georgia, in a news conference just yesterday, Governor Kemp said right now his focus is on beating back the virus. He wants to do everything he can, he says, to make sure that we have suppressed the virus before he even thinks about reopening the state for business. As you talk to leaders in business and government, what are you saying about that? And is Governor Kemp taking the right approach?
Well, certainly I think it's important to realize that different regions, different cities and towns will have their peak at different times. So, of course, it seems as if New York has reached their peak. But just yesterday, I was watching a news conference from, I believe, the mayor of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And his modeling shows that they are on a trajectory to increase the number of cases, of course, and not reach their peak. So we have to remember that the peaks will be different in different regions of the country. And the good news about that is those who have not yet reached their peak can do something about it. I think people have forgotten maybe a little bit the reason why it's very important to slow the spread. And that's so you would not overwhelm the health system in your particular region. You know, just a few weeks ago, we were talking appropriately because it's appropriate to plan. But just a few weeks ago, systems were talking about potentially making decisions about who has access to a ventilator. And the reason we have not had to make those decisions as of yet is because people planned. And so I would say excess bed capacity and excess ventilators is a good thing. And I also, I think that Governor Kemp is absolutely correct. It is a false choice between public health and the economy. And we have to make sure that we focus on this virus and slowing the spread. And then I believe it makes sense that the economy and loosening restrictions will follow, but will follow based on the science and the evidence.
Let me ask you one follow-up question to that. We know at this point, I think, clearly that testing is crucial to deciding when you really can reopen a state for business. We've got to have better numbers on where the virus is, where it isn't. And yet Georgia continues to lag behind in the number of tests that are made available. The governor again yesterday talked about expanding testing here, but unless it's expanded dramatically, whether it's in Georgia or some of the other states dealing with the virus, can you really start to say that a state, a community is safe if you don't have a better handle on testing and know who's got the virus and where they are?
You know, I think there is general consensus that we've been behind regarding testing capacity from the very beginning. One of the reasons the AMA, several weeks ago, called on the president to use all levers of government and the Defense Production Act, certainly it was ventilators, but it was also about testing. We absolutely have to have a dramatic, as you say, increase in testing capacity. And by the way, that is both the diagnostic test, And hopefully that will be those points of care rapid results tests. Those need to be available. We certainly cannot, it is much better to be able to have those tests within a half an hour versus 10 days. The other piece is the antibody test. Now, we've got a lot of folks working on that. None have been FDA approved yet, but those antibody tests will tell you if you've already been exposed. And that is also good data in decision-making and informed decision-making around loosening restrictions and going back to work. So there is no question that we have to dramatically increase testing capacity. And, you know, it's not just the test kits. It's the reagents. It's the mixed media. I know that's a little bit in the woods, but, supply chain issues are critical here. And we need a coordinated effort to do that, no question. And we have to make sure these tests are equitably available throughout the communities. We have a large rural population here in Georgia, and so folks it shouldn't be that they have to drive for miles and miles to get access to these tests, either in the rural areas or in our more suburban and urban areas.
Dr. Harris, Tamar Hallerman here from the AJC, and you said at a town hall with your national membership last week, you had very strong words about the government and their response, and you mentioned that the doctors have paid a terrible price for our nation's lack of preparation. And I'm wondering, looking specifically at Georgia, what would you say about the state's level of preparation, and how has that impacted our doctors here?
Well, certainly physicians and nurses and other healthcare workers on the front line are paying a terrible price. And not in every incident do they have the equipment that they need. And I know and am hearing from my colleagues about the worry and concern they face every day by not having the PPE that they need. And certainly, unfortunately, I also hear about my colleagues who are dying, ultimately paying the ultimate price. And so, there will be time in an after-action review, that's what happens in public health, to go back to see and review the level of preparation. It is not a hope. We must, again, at all levels, federal, state, and local, we must ensure that we have addressed these supply chain issues going forward, and that we have addressed the issues around having just basic safety equipment for those on the front line.
Kyle?
Dr. Harris, thanks so much for being here. This is Kyle from Peach Pod. You mentioned the mayor of Sioux Falls and the possibility that this pandemic would reach peak in rural areas potentially later. How concerned are you about the capacity of health systems in rural communities, particularly in states like Georgia's that have had high rates of uninsurance and hospital closures and hospital systems that have been more financially vulnerable in recent years?
Looking very concerned because, oftentimes rural areas may be low-resourced or under-resourced. Actually, I've talked to a couple of pediatricians in Georgia, and they know that in some of our rural areas, maybe there are one or two offices, and they're worried about the viability of those offices after we get over the worst of this pandemic. So very concerned about the rural areas, and as you know, if they were under-resourced or low-resourced, they don't have ventilators that perhaps the ventilator capacity that we may have here in the Atlanta metro area. And so, again, that is one of the reasons why we wanted to make sure that we did the social distancing. I like to use the term physical distancing. As Bill said, I'm a psychiatrist, and so I do want us to stay socially connected. But the reason, again, we were keen on that, and the AMA sent a letter to the National Governors Association requesting that they all enact stay-at-home shelter-in-place orders so we wouldn't have the peaks, so we wouldn't overwhelm capacity. And as we've seen, even in some of the most resourced areas of this country, they were worried about capacity. And so that just shows you that in our lower-resourced areas, such as our rural areas, I can't remember exactly, but I saw a report where there's only one or two ventilators. And, of course, rural hospitals often have a large catchment area, if you will. So that is a concern. And that's why you need a coordinated effort. Certainly, if someone is looking at a database and a tracking system where they know the needs and that you could, we had asked the federal government to do the tracking, but governors can certainly do this and know which areas of the state have one ventilator and which area of the state have 100 ventilators and track that. And then based on the data and the evidence can make sure the supplies get to the priority areas as they become hotspots. Again, hopefully if we do our physical distancing, that will alleviate that issue. But we also want to be prepared for the worst. We can certainly hope for the best, but it is our obligation to be prepared for the worst.
Amy, do you want to jump in?
I'd love to. Dr. Harris, this is Amy Steigerwalt from Georgia State University. And I wanted to ask you about the emerging data that suggests that there's a very clear racial disparity in how COVID-19 is affecting people, and that in particular, African Americans are appear to be catching the virus more frequently and also much more likely to die from it, and to sort of talk with you about that. The data in Georgia seems to suggest the same. And what does that say sort of more broadly about sort of health issues and perhaps sort of disparities in access to care that we're seeing across different racial communities?
Sure, absolutely. And this current pandemic is really shining a bright light on many issues sort of pre-COVID-19 that people knew about, but certainly now it's getting a bright spotlight. Certainly, this data, this early data regarding race and ethnicity, particularly around African Americans, that we have the best data, although it's quite limited and only coming out in a few cities, but does show, unfortunately, that there is a disproportionate impact. Now, many of us are not surprised because pre-COVID-19, there was a disproportionate impact in the African American community, higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of hypertension, and higher rates of asthma. Those are the very conditions that make you at higher risk for ICU admissions, more severe course of COVID-19, and death. And so if you have this COVID-19 crisis on top of a crisis that was pre-existing, the disproportionate impact, you are seeing these very tragic numbers, and health inequities are in the spotlight, and we have to make sure we address in the immediate need. The AMA sent a letter to HHS asking the HHS to be certain to collect, analyze, and then disseminate the data regarding race and ethnicity and communities with lower limited English proficiency, and then we'll have to use that data to track interventions. I mean, that's what we do. You know, we use the evidence and the data. And so very concerned about that. I do know the AMA will be leading on that. We have a new Center for Health Equity. We have a Chief Health Equity Officer and Dr. Aletha Maybank, as many know, our headquarters in Chicago. We're going to be leading in that conversation. But that's an all-in proposition. And we need, you know, the business community, transportation, city planners, government at all levels, to address this issue both acutely now, but also as we get on the other side of this pandemic.
You know, Dr. Harris, it seems to me that in response to what you're just talking about, now the question Amy asked you, this pandemic is raising, making us understand in so much more significant ways the fault lines that travel through our society. And no greater example of that is the way African Americans are struggling with this disease. And in fact, to give a little plug, we're going to devote an entire edition of Political Rewind to that subject tomorrow. Among our panelists will be Michael Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County. He's very worried about the incidence of African American positive cases in his county and beyond. So we're going to do a lot more with that on the show tomorrow. But let me, when you spoke to reporters during the National Press Club forum the other day, you were very clear about two things that I think are important to ask you to discuss with us. One was you pleaded with elected officials to follow the science, not politics, and pleaded with people to understand the difference between fact and rumor. And you cited a number of examples of rumors, such as, interestingly, we talked about African Americans and the virus, this rumor that was rife for quite a while that African Americans couldn't get the disease, that children couldn't get the disease. The disease has become politicized to some extent. We know that there are conservative voices out there saying to people, continuing to tell people that this disease is not as serious as the fake news media wants to make it. We know that the president at times has proposed theories, particularly in terms of the kind of drugs that he thinks can be useful, that don't necessarily support the science. How worried are you that we've turned, that there's a politicization of this virus that can have a long-term impact in a negative way?
Well, certainly, Bill, this virus does not discriminate, and it impacts all of us, age, race, gender. You know, everyone is susceptible to this virus, and we cannot afford to discuss this virus in political terms. We really do have to fall back on the science and the evidence, and that's one of the reasons the AMA did the town hall. And 2 days before the town hall, I gave an address on the importance of science. You know, science has been under attack for many years now, and we really have to. It's absolutely appropriate for everyone to have their own political views. A diversity of opinion and thought is a great thing in this country, but we should come to debates, particularly about the health and medicine based on the science and the evidence, informed on those. And so that's where we are at the AMA. It's about the science and the evidence. Actually, our patients required that of us before COVID-19, and they should. And we will continue to fall back on the science and the evidence on COVID-19 and really all of the work that we do, because our patients' lives depend on it.
You know, Tamar, we've only got Dr. Harris for a few more minutes because she is extremely busy these days. But I want to give you a chance to ask a question. But I also want to throw out an observation. And if you want to mention that quickly and then ask your question, Tamar, you know, I do think that this raises some serious questions. Yesterday's White House briefing was one of the most egregious examples of it being turned into a political event. And I do think that when you're talking about science rather than politics, it does raise, once again, this question of whether the network should be spending as much time doing these things live tomorrow. But go ahead and ask your question and comment on that if you want to.
Sure. And I mean, you've seen fighting with, you know, members of Trump's administration and networks that don't carry those briefings fully live. You know, they might only cover President Trump's remarks, but not Vice President Pence and kind of all the fighting around that. But I wanted to ask Dr. Harris about kind of the economic aspects of all of this and how it could impact the healthcare system. We've seen a staggering amount of people lose their jobs over the last month. We're hovering at an unemployment rate of something around 10%. I've seen as high as 15%. And people lose their jobs. They also lose their health care. And Georgia is the state that hasn't expanded Medicaid. And you talk to Democrats and they say that's something that could really help the situation that we're seeing in hospitals. And I'm curious if you could talk about that a little bit more and the economic toll, what it means for health care, and what you would like to see in Georgia.
Well, certainly health and the economy are intertwined. Certainly we know that. But again, it's a false choice to say one or the other because they are so interconnected. As you may know, the American Medical Association supported the Affordable Care Act. It was not a perfect piece of legislation, but it certainly moved us forward with having less uninsured in this country. And we believe the path forward is to build upon the progress of the Affordable Care Act. Certainly, as part of that, we need a very strong safety net system in this country. And so that is why we do encourage everyone to expand Medicaid. I have to say, certainly as a psychiatrist and knowing sort of pre-ACA, we know that so many, I know that so many of my patients were able to have access to better health care, mental health care through Medicaid. And so we certainly expand that. And then, of course, this is not about health insurance, but certainly expanding the tax credits and subsidies and all of those things, but certainly moving forward. So we certainly need to continue to have that conversation, and a strong safety net is key. And the AMA is very supportive of a very strong safety net.
Dr. Harris, I'd love to be able to give Kyle Hayes one last chance to ask you a question, and then I promise we'll let you go back to your other work. Kyle, you get the last question.
Thanks, Bill. I think building off of that, another sort of downstream effect that may be on people's horizons right now is the impact of the economic slowdown on state budgets and state revenue. Before the crisis set in, Georgia was already considering budget cuts to state-funded behavioral health services. So how worried are you about other downstream effects on our healthcare system, maybe beyond those directly impacted by the ACA, but are funded, for instance, by state funds or other public spending on health services?
So is there any reduction in spending in health services, as you might imagine, worries me personally, and of course worries the AMA. And so, again, health is such a significant driver of, you know, as we talked about, being interconnected with the economy. You know, as we know as businesses make decisions about where they want to come, they look at health, they look at education, they look at, you know, all those things that are the social determinants of health, which, Bill, you probably will be talking about more tomorrow regarding the disparity. So that is something at the AMA, you know, we are monitoring and tracking a lot of issues. Again, physician practice viability. You know, sometimes folks lump us all in together. Certainly all of us are healthcare stakeholders, but hospital needs are different from, you know, the small solo private practice needs. And so we will have to have a diversity of options and solutions as we go forward. This will be a new normal, and we will have to make sure that we are leading the conversations. I'll say one more, just learning again. We'll all be learning. There are certain things that we are doing at this moment that we should be doing in an emergency. And I, you know, we will have to have thoughtful conversations about what should we continue to do and what we shouldn't continue to do. You know, there are very few one-size-fits-all. Actually, I haven't seen one. One-size-fits-all solutions. Solutions are better when they're targeted. And someone is certainly reviewing the impact over the long term. So I'm worried about any reduction in support for healthcare and physicians in many areas. And so we will certainly continue to monitor those at the AMA and be a part of that conversation.
Well, Dr. Harris, we're so grateful to you for taking time to talk with us. And considering you represent the biggest national organization that speaks on behalf of doctors, nurses, other medical professionals, I guess it's fair to give you, to pass on to them, thanks for the extraordinary job that the medical professionals in our state and beyond are doing in risky times. They're taking their lives in their hands to serve the community, and I can't imagine a higher calling than that. And I thank you so much for being with us and the way you've represented the people in your field on the show today. Thanks a lot, Dr. Harris. Stay safe, please.
Thank you, and you all stay safe as well. And to everyone listening, please stay home. Unless you have to go out for groceries or medicine, stay home. Thank you.
Great advice. Thanks, Dr. Harris. All right, let's get our first break of the show out of the way. When we come back, we're going to talk some politics on Political Rewind. We are back with Tamar Hallerman, Kyle Hayes, and Amy Steigerwalt on Political Rewind. Amy, let's start with you. You know, early on, early on in the virus, Governor Kemp took a lot of criticism for his reluctance to order shelter-in-place rules for the entire state. He said over and over again he wanted to watch how things unfold. He didn't think the whole state was impacted. He had a lot of reasons for not doing it. He did, of course, eventually order a shelter-in-place, and we have seen the curve come down a bit as a result of that. But, you know, it's interesting. I thought, Amy, that yesterday during his news conference, he did resist a temptation that we've seen other Republican governors really leap into. So you've got Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas, you've got the governor of Texas, you've got the president of the United States all saying, gee, we've got to start figuring out how to open business back up. We can't let this kill our economy. Kemp stuck to business yesterday in terms of dealing with the virus. He talked about urging for expansion of testing and test results being coming out more quickly. They've got now emergency hospital beds set up in the World Congress Center and other locations. It felt yesterday like Governor Kemp really was embracing the need to focus very specifically on this. Do you think that's a fair observation?
I do, and I think some of it may have to do with where the outbreaks have actually taken place in Georgia, right? We're a bit different from a lot of places where, like, technically the sort of highest number of cases are in the Metro Atlanta area, but the largest sort of outbreaks, particularly when you look at the rate per the sort of per capita rate are in a lot of the rural counties. So Darby County, around sort of Sumter, Albany, places like that, we've really seen the rural areas having issues, and a lot of it also sort of reacting to sort of where there was the biggest hesitation. So we know that a lot of outbreaks have been tied to funerals. We know that they've been tied to church services or other sort of large community events that were still going on. And so I think some of that is also a reaction to the places where we've seen real issues, particularly in Georgia, and particularly hitting the rural areas that Kemp has focused a lot of attention on throughout his career, and especially during his governorship.
Kyle, did you feel that, you know, it's interesting, again, I mean, we know that any number of Republican governors have taken their cues from what President Trump does, and perhaps early on, the governor of Georgia, Governor Kemp, did that when the president was downplaying the seriousness of the virus. But it struck me that he's now in two ways made it clear that he is willing to distance himself from the president. One, when he named Kelly Loeffler, despite the president wanting Doug Collins to be the choice for Senate. And then again, in not kind of towing the president, the White House line right now, that we got to get business going again in Georgia. Kyle?
Yeah, and I think that that is somewhat reflective of his view on the testing. He conceded that testing was not where it needed to be, and I think he has this understanding that if testing is not where you need it to be, then it makes it really difficult to impossible to take the economic steps of beginning to open things up and doing so safely. I mean, if you think about big Georgia industries and hospitality or the movie industry, those are industries that would be difficult or impossible to do with some element of social distancing still required. I mean, so I think he understands that reality, that without testing, without the building blocks in place to open things back up, you have to keep the focus on combating the virus and the public health response.
So, Tamar, I want to get you in here, but let's listen to a little of what Governor Kemp said in his news conference yesterday. Sam, why don't we go first with number one?
Despite our partnerships and undeniable progress, our testing numbers in Georgia continue to lag. As I've said before, the status quo is unacceptable, and Dr. Toomey is pushing public health officials across our state to collect more specimens and to process more tests.
And Tamar, Kyle mentioned it. The governor mentions it. Testing has been an issue here. We've had a hard time getting real numbers on how many tests are actually being given to what percent of the population here. And we know for sure that there are far fewer tests being given here. Talk about that.
Yeah, my colleagues crunched the numbers on this yesterday, and they found that as of midday yesterday, Georgia ranked 45th out of 50 states for tests per capita. And that was something that Kemp mentioned, you know, was not acceptable. And we heard Dr. Toomey yesterday talk about how they're expanding the criteria for who is eligible for tests now in Georgia. So that includes asymptomatic people who were definitely in contact with somebody who has the coronavirus. And that sort of thing. So perhaps that will help, but it still takes a while for a lot of these tests to be processed. And you're seeing in other parts of the country, tests having to be sent to far-flung places because local labs are just completely overloaded. And look, there's plenty of time for Governor Kemp to change his mind if the numbers do in fact go down. You've seen Trump talk about opening up the economy by early May. You know, it's still mid-April. Perhaps if things trend downward, you know, there's still time for Kemp to change his mind. But I think there's also a mindfulness. You don't want to be the leader who reopened the state and only to see a second wave for things to get really worse. I've been writing a story about the Spanish flu outbreak in 1918 and how Georgia handled things back then. And initially, the city council of Atlanta voted to close down a ton of businesses for 2 weeks. And the political pressure became so severe, they reopened everything after 2.5 weeks. And lo and behold, within about a month and a half, infection rates surged again. So I'm sure folks see that and they don't want that to be them.
You know, the classic story, of course, about 1918 virus, it flu, is that the comparison between St. Louis and Philadelphia, Philadelphia fought back against the virus pretty well. They limited crowds getting together. They did establish their own version of physical distancing. And when they thought they had the virus beat, 2 days after they announced it was gone, there was a rally, a war bonds rally, that 200,000 people in Philadelphia attended. And guess what? Within days, the number of cases spiked dramatically, and Philadelphia was right back in the middle of the worst possible situation. St. Louis did it completely differently. They really kept people isolated from one another, and they never did have terrible problems with it. So, you know, Kyle, it does come back to if we don't have tests. I don't know about you, Kyle. You're in Washington right now, but I don't know when I'm going to, you know, if they tell me on May 15th that we've pretty well beaten back coronavirus, how safe am I going to feel, nevertheless, going out into the streets, going to the stores, going to the malls, if we haven't had extensive enough testing to really have a sense of where the virus is and isn't, Kyle?
Well, and this speaks to the false choice between the economy and the public health response, because I think a lot of people will feel that way, that if they don't feel confident that it is safe to go out in public, to go shopping at retail establishments, to go to the movies, to go get their haircut, things like that, they probably won't continue to do those things. And parts of the economy will still continue to struggle just because of the choices that consumers make. When you do look back at the 1918 flu epidemic, you also find that the cities that took the most aggressive public health responses, their economies performed better in the wake of that pandemic. And so that's, you know, just more evidence that the interests in both of these cases, the public health and the economic case, those interests are aligned in terms of beating the virus to bring the economy back.
All right, let's do this. Let's talk about one more story that relates to the virus and then take a break and come back and talk about the politics that unfolded in Wisconsin over the last week. Amy Steigerwald. No virus is good enough to beat down the forces, the pro-gun forces in the state of Georgia. In many other states, I suspect that's true as well. I want to play a little bit of an ad that Paul Brown has now put up on his website. Paul Brown, of course, former one of the most, he bragged that he was the most conservative member of Congress when he served in the U.S. House. Way back when he first ran for that race, he featured an ad in which he was shown firing guns, and he's back again. He's now running for Senate race in Senate race number 2, and the spot that he recorded shows him firing an assault style weapon, and this is just a little bit of what he says.
In uncertain times like these, the right to defend yourself, your property, and your family could not be more important. Whether it's looting hordes from Atlanta or a tyrannical government from Washington, there are few better liberty machines than an AR-15.
Amy Steigerwald, looting hordes from Atlanta. What do you make of that commercial?
The thought that I had is that likely the hordes would be rushing for the beaches and not necessarily coming to loot on anything. It's also reminding me a bit of when the 5th District was accused of burning at one point, which was a shock to all of us who actually live in the 5th District. But I think it is suggesting kind of broader issues that still exist in all of this. There's definitely some subtle and not so subtle hints in there about who's more likely to live in Atlanta. It's a evil urban city. It is more likely to have racial minorities, those who have to lower class and are not kind of the good people that live out in the rural areas. And it's very much tapping into sort of those feelings and those types of fears to try to capitalize on them. And unfortunately, studies do show that people respond to fear-baiting ads really pretty well, that it kind of raises your endorphins and it also causes you to perhaps take different answers than you and pick different sort of policy outcomes or vote for different people, particularly if you then think that that candidate can protect you from whatever the fearful thing is.
Tamara, you certainly covered Paul Brown and know him well from your tenure as the Washington correspondent for the AJC.
Yeah, and kind of gun rights are very much a central part of who he is. He first got involved in politics. He's a trained doctor, and you know, that's what he did professionally. But he first got involved in politics as a lobbyist for a hunting organization. And if you ever visited his office when he was in when he was serving in the House, it was filled with giant taxidermied animals that he hunted, including in Africa on safari, giant animals. And there's an incredible video from my former colleagues at Roll Call where he gives this office tour with giant, semi-terrifying animals all over the wall. But it's very much a part of who he is. And look, it's a great way to kind of get your base out, the Republican conservative base, when you talk about people taking away your guns. And it's something that we've seen even in the last couple of weeks here in Georgia, where we saw a gun owner suing Governor Kemp and a Fulton County probate judge because some state courts have suspended issuing carrying licenses.
Yeah, you know, Kyle, we can all sort of, in a sardonic way, chuckle over the extreme kind of messaging that Paul Brown puts out here, especially the hordes, the looting hordes from Atlanta. He insists there's no racial messaging there, but I think people can reach their own conclusions pretty easily on that. But Kyle, the fact of the matter is, number one, you got a huge field of people who want that Senate seat, and you got to find some way to distinguish yourself. Tamar sort of referenced that. And number two, there is a considerable population of conservative, conspiracy-minded people out there who are reached by a message like this, and especially in times of crisis like we're in right now, it's hard to predict what messages like this might do to motivate those most conservative people who do believe in conspiracies.
Yeah, well, I think number one for Paul Brown's ad, I think all that ruckus that he's hearing from Atlanta is people going onto their apartment balconies every evening to cheer on healthcare workers and other people who are working to save lives amidst this pandemic. This is an ad that you can chuckle at, but I didn't have a lot of patience for this ad. I think particularly at this time, I think it sort of leans into some of that group of the Republican base that does have those beliefs and conspiracy-minded thoughts about what is going on now. And I think that Tamar mentioned the lawsuit that was filed related to issuing gun permits, and that was reported alongside another story from the AJC showing that gun sales and sales of ammunition were all up in the lead up to this crisis. And that has other real world effects that are overshadowed amidst this crisis. Number one being that people who are survivors of domestic violence are more likely to be victims of that violence during this time of quarantine when people are locked in their homes together and when apparently people appear to have more access to guns. So I think that there are important issues here that can't be overlooked amidst this ad from Paul Brown.
Yeah. All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way and then turn to what I've been promising all along, the interesting results out of the Wisconsin presidential primary. This is Politico Rewind. We'll be right back. Tamar Hallerman, Wisconsin voters went to the polls a week ago, last Tuesday, to vote for in presidential preference primary, but also an important Supreme Court seat that was coming open. And of course, many people were horrified when they saw the scenes of voters crowding into polling places, standing in long lines without the proper physical distance between them and the person in front of them. There were all sorts of awful scenes that unfolded. And we know that what happened there was that Democrats argued that the race, that election, should be held almost entirely by, should be done by mail, and that the courts should authorize the extension of the deadline for another week or so to allow people to vote by mail, not be exposed to each other. And Republicans fought back hard, saying, no, no, we can't delay this primary. And it seemed relatively clear to Mar that Republicans were hoping that the way they handled this thing would put their Republican Supreme Court nominee into office, largely because she would have expanded the Republican majority on that state Supreme Court to act on a voter suppression case that could take as many as 200,000 or more Wisconsin voters off the polls. Well, long story short, the liberal Democrat won the election by almost 10 points tomorrow. Fascinating turnout and result.
Yeah, and ahead of all the voting, you heard Democratic leaders already kind of complaining about the outcome that they thought they were going to get. You heard Tom Perez, the chair of the DNC, calling it voter suppression on steroids, Republicans trying to steal the election in Wisconsin. You had the chair of the Democratic Party there talking about lawsuits that were going to be filed by voters who were unable to cast absentee ballots, that sort of thing. But actually, there's the key Supreme Court race there that you mentioned, where there was a liberal challenger who ended up beating a conservative incumbent justice by quite a big margin. And in general, these are races where the margin of victory tends to be pretty narrow in Wisconsin. So I think Democrats took it as a really good sign when this liberal challenger ended up defeating the incumbent by almost 10 points.
Yeah. And Amy, of course, Joe Biden was declared the winner in that race, too, by a pretty wide margin. We already knew he was the presumptive nominee of the party. But I guess, Amy, if I'm the Trump campaign, I look at what happened in Wisconsin, and I'd be a little nervous about what it might say about a very important state in November.
Definitely, because not only did people turn out in the middle of a global pandemic, with lots of concerns, right? Especially, I mean, one of the big things that happened is that in Milwaukee County, the normal 180 polling places got reduced to just 5. So you also had, right, these sort of very long lines. But the weather was also horrific. It was hailing, it was raining, and yet people still waited in 2-3 hour long lines to be able to vote. And I think it really is a sign of how much people are invested in the results of these elections and wanting to see their person win, or perhaps, you know, the person that they dislike lose. And I think that that doesn't bode well for Trump. I mean, the other part to put it with is that the sort of rally around the flag effect that he had gotten, that bump in the polls from there being this sort of national crisis, has dissipated, if not fallen. And so his approval ratings are also now very low, and he doesn't have a strong economy to be able to run on. And those are all things that definitely harm the incumbent in any presidential race.
You know, Kyle, I said earlier that the coronavirus is exposing fault lines that we knew were there but are making them more real and more dramatic. And to some extent, what happened in Wisconsin is an example of that in terms of partisan lines, Republicans insisting on in-person voting, perhaps to suppress the vote in large cities and increase the vote in rural areas. But one way or the other, their effort backfired. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about what this means for Wisconsin in November.
I think it raises the possibility that Republicans could be wrong about a reflexive opposition to absentee voting. I mean, expanding access to absentee voting. They could be wrong by assuming that that would actually benefit them. Our House Speaker David Ralston said that, you know, mailing ballots out to everyone would hurt Republicans. He later tried to walk that back, saying that he was talking about voter fraud. But I think, given the fact that the pandemic, the virus is a higher risk for older people that make up more of the Republican base, some Republican voters may be more likely to feel like, oh, I don't want to go out and vote at the polls. I'll stay home. Maybe they forgot to ask for their absentee ballot. The political ramifications for Republicans could be different than what they expected by opposing absentee balloting.
Kyle Hayes, you get the last word in today's Political Rewind. Thank you for joining us from Washington. By the way, what do you have up on Peach Pod right now? What can people listen to?
We've been taking a look at the response to the virus as well, particularly the response from the federal government, the failures on testing, and also some of the economic measures that have been working their way through Congress.
All right. That's Peach Pod. You can subscribe to it wherever you get your podcast, just as you can, Political Rewind. Tamar Hallerman, thank you. We always enjoy Tuesdays when you are with us. And A.B. Steigerwald, our best to you as well. Thank you for listening today. Tomorrow, again, we'll look at African Americans and coronavirus with DeKalb County CEO Michael Thurmond and others on the subject. I'm Bill Nigut. See you tomorrow.